Longtime fans of the show should be familiar with the lender formerly known as Sue Pullen, and I'm pleased to announce that she's back, fresh off a rebrand and ready to help as Sue Mackey. Sue is a certified mortgage advisor at Fairway Independent Mortgage, an equal housing lender who focuses on finding the right product for you and your needs. She has over 20 years of experience helping thousands of homeowners. Whether it's purchasing, refinancing, or even a reverse mortgage, Sue will help. Sue's licensed in 36 states now, so reach out and let Sue Mackey it happen for you. The best way to reach her is just give her a call at 520-977-7904 or in an email, spullen@fairwaymc.com. Fairway Independent Mortgage has an MLS number of 2289. Sue Mackey has an MLS number of 206048. That email again, spullen@fairwaymc.com. And that phone number is 520-977-7904. Shoot Sue an email and let her know she needs to update that address.
So another one that I thought was that was funny that a lot of people did really well on was productive efficiency. Like, that was one of those questions that I was like, nobody's going to know unless they know what that definition is. And I think Trust did really good on this one. That's when that gave me the first, because that's one of the first few questions. Mm-hmm. I was like, what do you know? What do you do? This is
why do you know that?
Why do you know that?
Disclaimer time. This is where I tell everyone to lighten up. It's just a podcast. Trading is like that roller coaster at the amusement park. Thrilling, unpredictable, and potentially stomach churning. What works for one person might leave another clutching their hat in the wind. Our hosts and guests, they're awesome, knowledgeable, full of insights, but we're not financial advisors. So don't rush to make any investment decisions based solely on our banter. Always consult with a professional or do your own research. Plus, let's face it, we like to have fun, laugh, enjoy the trading ride together. It's all in the name of good podcasting fun. So remember, take it easy, don't bet the farm, and keep your seatbelts on at all times. Thank you for listening.
All right, got a couple guys in here. Eric, do you want to just kind of explain how this is going to work then, or what our plan is?
Yeah, absolutely. So I know we did the challenge of the final exam for a microeconomics course, and I will... Oh, we got Robert. Hi, Robert. So basically this is... Now, I want to be clear, just in case there's any students who will come back and listen to this, think they can glean answers. These were modified from the final, but they weren't modified in a way that would change the curriculum outcome of it, of how you would grade on it. And no, we let you guys take it. And I got to say, I don't want to say I was surprised how well everybody did, because you guys are obviously... You know, a pretty large cut above what I think the average Joe, for better or worse, walking around probably thinks about this stuff, because microeconomics is the study of markets. And everybody who is taking time to listen to this podcast or sit through like a 50 question final exam probably really cares about markets. Right. And yeah, so what I was shocked by is, well, I was shocked by two things, but I guess they go together. Is one, the application questions, which are usually the hardest questions, were massacred. You guys destroyed them. But like the very direct questions that I would have thought would have just been absolute layups was a bloodbath. I was like,
what do you think that is, or why? Is it just it's the difference between practical experience and book knowledge kind of thing?
Yeah. I think it's a little bit far to the trees. Like if you do, it's really, really funny. If you take a lot of people who do math every day for their life and you're like, give them like a Pindes equation, like, you know, just orders of operations, you'll see them stare at it. And these are the same people who like will do can calculate derivative in their head. And they're like, oh, I got to go back and think about how to do that.
Right.
So I think it's that what we do, especially in Econ 201, is you're talking about building a foundation of microeconomics, but you're building that foundation. But at the end of the day, it's the insight, it's the application that you really use very heavily. And I'm going to take this lamp off. So I think you guys are using the application so much and understand markets so well. Wow, that lamp is super hot. That hasn't even been on that long. Already. That you guys know the application. You know how to apply these thoughts. But when it comes to questions like, you're probably not thinking that much about, you know, sensitivity of demand. So, no. Yeah.
So you're saying our foundation is shit.
No, I'm just saying you spend more time in the living room than you do in the basement.
Yeah, fair enough.
It's a good metaphor. I'm proud of that, Kyle. That's really good. That was a good metaphor.
You saved that one, or is it just
get right at the top of my head? I'm on fire today. I've had drank a lot of coffee. I had a cigar. I'm in. I'm a globe right here. Is that a vacuum cleaner? A vacuum cleaner right now.
Normally, when you land a joke that good, I just cut it right there. We'll just call it an episode.
Hey, have a good one, guys. That's why episodes are so long.
All right. Well, so how many? We did like what? Was it like 25 questions that we took, or is it 50?
So I did.
I think it was. It didn't,
yeah, it ended up being
50,
like,
wasn't it?
Yeah, it was individual question marks. It came out to 50 even, but I think the total questions, because I removed a lot of the graphs. There were some graphs, some I took off. I think the total individual questions were in like the 40s, or low 40s. So,
do we want to run through the scoring then of how everyone did right off the bat one more time? Just kind of recap that.
Yes, let me bring that up. But no, I was very happy. Like to see that again, like I was expecting kind of high performance from you guys to say the least, but yeah, I just thought it was cool just to see how people who like aren't studying this actively are using it.
Right.
And at the end of the day, that's the wicked interesting part about it.
So which is the more effective teaching vehicle then? Multiple years of trying to learn how to trade the markets or taking a 2-year class?
I would take you guys in a heartbeat. Wouldn't even think twice about it.
Yours is probably cheaper though.
My class is if you're a West Virginia resident, my class is 100% free. Thank you to Ken Kendrick of the multiple successful ventures, but specifically he's the owner of the Arizona Diamondbacks. Donated a good chunk of change to us.
Is that why Arizona does something similar then?
Yeah. Arizona
was based off of your GPA. If your GPA was above like a B average or something like that, like you got a free ride to any in-state school.
Wait, really?
They were doing something like that. I don't know if that meant like state run institutions. So maybe like U of A probably doesn't fall under that category. But NAU and those ones definitely would.
So it's funny because our chair of the Kendrick Institute, she's from Arizona. So I wouldn't be surprised if it was brought over there. I know she was very active on having like high school teachers take, basically like a master's of arts in economics to be able to teach economics better at high school level.
Yeah.
No, it's just awesome. So I have the list up here.
Okay.
All right. We have Truss at 22, Robert at 21. Anything above 20, by the way, is insane. That would probably, you'd probably grade out like 85, 90. Knowing how I grade, I'd probably give you an A. Bayman, which is a great name, 20. Joe, 19. Kyle, 18.
Did you grade the one that I took seriously or the one that I just was doing as like a test run to see how the thing worked?
I know, I graded your serious one.
Okay.
It was 18. Your test run was a 14. I remember that one.
I was wondering if that one was like,
I was like, he clicked through this. I know Kyle.
Yes.
Kyle, 18.
Did you notice it was all ABBA? Abacadabra?
No, was it?
Yeah. I was like, maybe this one.
No, the way I had it set up, it was auto scoring. So I could only see your answer, not A, B, C, or D. Oh, I completely forgot what they were.
Yeah.
Aglodon, 75. Our dear Canadian friend Joel, 17. And then Harvey at 16. So the fact that the top and the bottom were 6 points apart is crazy. So a 16 on here, especially because Harvey, I think, had the highest amount of the highest difficulty. He got the most right there.
Right.
So I would say the grades here would range somewhere between like low 80s to low 90s, maybe like high 70s to low 90s. I'd have to, if we looked at the pure difficult ranking, depending on how you scale it, because sometimes you do like a 1, 3, 5, a 1, 2, 3.
Yeah.
Some places
yeah.
do a 1, 5, 10. I'm not a huge fan of that big of a spread. If there's a question weighted at 1 and a question weighted at 10, you get some real distorted lucky answers. You want to remove just lucky guessing from that grading. But no, it was really, really impressive. It was Truss. I mean, that Truss, Robert, and Bayman, I mean, just like absolutely crushed it.
I think one of them actually had a economics or studied economics. I think that might have been Truss.
Yeah, I would be surprised. I don't know if Truss is in here, but I would not be surprised just because like some of his he got right. I was like, oh, that's somebody who's like knows this pretty well. Like there were certain questions, a few people like there were certain questions that were just a desert for correct answers. But they were like terminology questions. Which I'm like, yeah, you just don't know that terminology. You don't use it. You understand the concept. I care much more about my students understanding concept than terminology. Like I often say, I grade my students not on like rote benchmarking that you'd see like nothing against high school teachers, but like how high school teachers have to grade.
Right.
Where mine's more just like how good of an economist are you relative to what I would expect in 201. And that's the best part about teaching at a university is that you get that ability to, you have your confines, how you have to grade and those standards, because you obviously it's an accreditation for the university. So you have those standards, but then you're able to step inside of that and understand how is this student learning? Mm-hmm. And I always love that. I love seeing that progression. Like I have students who will just A right across. I'm like, God, love them. You know, when I took Econ 201, I knew I wanted to be an economist. I was direct admit, and I was like that. I was trying to like break the scales. But I love seeing that. But I also love seeing the student who starts with like a 60 and they end up finishing with an A or a B in the course. I'm like, yeah, like
somebody who goes from knowing nothing to like turn around and yeah.
Kyle, you know me pretty well. Like I can be a little bit of a sentimental person. So like at the end of the semester, I always send out emails to like the students who started with like, you know, got a 55 on the first exam, and they finished with a B. And I'm like, that is going to benefit you more in life than this B in this course. Mm-hmm. Like that tenacity. You didn't drop the course.
Right.
And sometimes you drop a course, that's fine. But the people who push through, I'm always like, I respect that so much. Like I love that.
Well, speaking of pushing through, well, we should take a look at some of the questions that were missed more frequently by us than, and actually I think it might be kind of interesting to see like what the class tended to miss too and kind of compare how we did on those.
Yeah, absolutely. So the big, and again, for the students who may be trying to glean this as some sort.
We got an easier version, I know.
The terminology and numbers and rankings are all anonymized enough where they can't, this is going to end up on Chegg in a few weeks. So terminology, the vocabulary was, students an excellent vocabulary because I'm very heavy on the vocab during office hours and stuff like that. That's where you guys did weakest, which is at the end of the day, that's not how you win a Nobel Prize for vocabulary. The weirdest ones were the graphs. There was like a group of people who dominated the graphs and a group of people who I think just clicked whatever answer they could relatively thought. Like, and trust, I do apologize. So I think Trust and Robert, I'm going to talk most about here because they crushed a lot of those like really technical ones. That's why, like when I saw the grades, I was like, did they find like this exam already? This is a clean exam. This is impressive. I know Robert's in the chat. Robert, especially you did very, very. You had a couple like max difficulty questions that you sailed through. Like you just Yeah, so, you know, one of my favorite ones was the second question, which is in economics, the term blank means additional or extra. And very funny. So nobody, I don't think anybody picked the word. There was optimal, marginal, equity, or allocative. And the most trader mindset of all time, tons of people picked equity. Like tons of people. And I'm like, you're right, but you're not. Right. Which is like, I think I made the joke to you. I think this was you and I talking on the phone. And I made a joke about this where I was like, that's one where I feel like why people hate economists. He was like, what's equity in your house? Well, you paid down your house and now your liability is smaller than
the equity would be the extra surplus that you have in there.
But the answer is marginal. Economics is a lot of times you say economics is the study of margins. It's like how different are two things?
Is that why you hear marginal benefits all the time?
Marginal benefit, marginal cost. Yeah, it's the first derivative of production in the production line, sorry, the demand line, the supply line. So I was like, somebody's going to flame me in a group chat or something for marking that one wrong.
Dang, is Harvey in here? Because I feel like he'd be the one to
lead
the charge.
Yeah, I think it would be, and I wouldn't even blame him. This is right. Where like economics comes. Like I always joke that like, you know, my goal throughout my 10+ years of being an economist is like I want to make economics what it is, which is it's a science of people, and I want individuals to understand that. I'm an Austrian, like I'm a big man on the spot guy. Like I think Hayek was right that economics is not made by people in ivy towers with a bunch of vellum with fancy ink written on it, that it's it's made by individuals trying to make their best decision. Road to serfdom. I'm gonna have to shut off the chat for my view because I just know like I'm gonna giggle the entire time and I apologize.
Let it go.
But yeah, so that's one like somebody would be like, oh, this is why we hate economists, because we're telling that anything additional or extra on an asset we hold is an equity. It's like, well, we're just looking for the dictionary definition of margin. I don't think I said this to you, part of me wanted to put like an E and just have open answers. But I thought, I just thought it would go off the rails.
Oh, that would have been amazing, actually.
But yeah, I was very nervous about that.
I don't know if I would have taken it.
No, it would have been like 9 hours of people just making fun of me. It would have been great.
I don't think I would have gotten anything right.
so that was so that was definitely one of them. I'm just scrolling. I have like the, just so everybody knows, on one side I have like the test up, and I have some of the answers on the other side. So if you see my eyes like duck to the right, it's because I'm making sure what I'm saying is demonstrably true.
I'm only recording audio on this, just so you know.
Oh, that makes me feel way better.
If you do a screen share, then it'll record that. But other than that, no.
That makes me feel a little better. Oh, right? So nobody's gonna see my random vacuum in the background. Nope. Sad. All right. So another one that I thought was that was funny that a lot of people did really well on was productive efficiency. Like, that was one of those questions that I was like, nobody's gonna know unless they know what that definition is. And I think Trust did really good on this one. That's when that gave me the first, because that's one of the first few questions. Mm-hmm. I was like, what do you know? What do you do? This is
why do you know that?
Why do you know that? So like productive efficiency, it's when a good or service is produced at the lowest possible cost. And the flip side of that is allocative efficiency, which is every good or service is produced up to the point where marginal benefit equals marginal cost. So it's like allocative efficiency is producing at the equilibrium, where productive efficiency is like you're making everything as cheap as humanly possible.
Yeah. So I think that question actually specifically, and you're comparing it to the previous one, which was a definition, like that one was one that actually kind of made sense. I think that was one I was able to like kind of work through in my head and get to an answer that made sense. Whereas I did the same thing with the other one, but got to the wrong answer because you guys are stupid.
No. Allocative efficiency, you have to like know what we're referring to when we say allocative efficiency. Where productive efficiency, I was surprised, not surprised, but it was nice to see that, like, Kyle, just what you said.
What was worked? Production, and allocative, meaning that's something that you set aside. So to me, like, it was able to kind of work through that way.
Yeah. The best one was like when we get into the trading questions. You have an absolute advantage because that's obviously that relates to absolute advantage in trade. And it's, you know, whenever you can produce more of something than others with the same resources. It's funny, a lot of people picked A, which was can produce something at a lower opportunity cost than others. And that phrase, opportunity cost, was devastating in a lot of the questions. Most of the questions that people got wrong had the word opportunity cost in it, because the way economists define opportunity cost is different than the finance world defines opportunity cost, to the point where like it becomes problematic when, like, I'm a CFO, so I speak to finance people, and I've given presentations at conferences and stuff, and that term opportunity cost, a lot of I think most people would say your opportunity cost is the value of not doing an action, right? Or the value of doing it, or the cost of doing an action. In economics, opportunity cost is actually the value of the second most beneficial action you can take.
Wait. What?
Yeah. Yes. And it follows a very... And especially this is an econ...
So it's kind of like, I can do this thing or I can do this thing. What's the difference between the two value-wise? Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So a lot of people look at it from a trading standpoint, which I think is the most real-world tangible way to look at it, which is, hey, like... All right, if I don't make this trade and the stock goes up, you know, 100%, the cost of me not doing that was this 100% gain. Where in economics, we would say, well, it wouldn't be. It would be, was that the preferred strategy? And then what was the second preferred strategy? And the value of that second preferred strategy is the opportunity cost. Because that's what you would have had to trade, what you would have had to avoid trading to make that first trade. Which is really funny, because at the end of the day, you should only care about did my asset go up or down, not like what could have been the second order of effect.
And that's... But see, I think that's something that we do consider, because like, especially when you're thinking of like where your money's tied up in. If I have a trade on with, like, say, Intel right now, and I don't like the way Intel is going, there's an opportunity cost that money is tied up into one trade now, when there's other trades out there that maybe my money could be better spent backing instead.
And Kyle, you know, you're 100% right on, because that train of logic you just said, if you follow that, the group crushed it. Mm-hmm. Like, that train of logic, like, the guys dominated that. So again, like, a lot of the losses were like really esoterical economic wording, vocabulary, and then just like what I would describe as borderline theoretical economics that even people who do economics professionally know of and kind of talk about, but in reality kind of don't even acknowledge that much, because it's too theoretical. and you guys know this, like when something's so theoretical, you can't make a decision on it. Like it's like, right.
It's the fine line between brilliance and idiocracy.
I was going to say insanity, but that's probably insanity. Right there.
That's the word I was searching for too.
So our first true or false question, highly controversial. The basis for trade is comparative advantage, not absolute advantage. It was like dead middle split. With the group, half got it right, said true, and the other half got it false. And I would love to know, like, the I wouldn't say political leanings, but their thoughts on tariffs. Like, that group probably has a very clean definition of tariffs. So why does the U.S. trade, right? Like, we can produce pretty much anything. Why does the U.S. trade food? We produce the U.S. consumes the most calories per person, but we are the world's leading. And we have the largest agricultural sector in the world, and we lead the world in agricultural exports. But like, why? Why? Mm-hmm. And we are very high up in, I think we are per capita. I think Japan is the highest developed nation for per capita importation of calories. But why? Why would we trade with anybody else? It's because like the U.S. like we like avocados, we like cheeses, mm-hmm, right? And we can't produce those as efficiently. And say when Mexico produces avocados, because our labor inputs are too high. Mexico is better off in focusing on building what it or producing what it's really, 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 really good at. Because in the U.S., we'd have to take somebody off. Like, I don't know, this is an extreme example, but remove a computer scientist to go out work in a field is a bigger opportunity cost than somebody in Mexico whose options are maybe like cottage industries or exportation farming. So you're like, oh, okay, it's a comparative. They have a comparative advantage to produce that good. So we're going to buy it from you because it's going to be cheaper because my opportunity cost is so high to lose that like intensified economic worker.
Right.
So yes, I would be very curious if we could like split the group up and just give them an anonymous survey on the thoughts on tariffs.
So what was the actual question again?
The basis for trade is comparative advantage, not absolute advantage, true or false.
You saying that is true, is based That's on true. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Based on comparative advantage. Otherwise, nobody would trade with the U.S.
Yeah.
Which looks like that might be a thing happening.
Hey, no politics.
Joel materializes behind me.
There was one specific question on there that I remembered, but I cannot for the life of me remember what that question was now that I wanted to ask about.
So I want to bring up the one I did for... There was one that Kyle was talking crap to me about.
That one, yeah. I know there's one.
I have like three questions that look the exact same. So I want to make sure I have this right. 216, when are we doing this?
It'd be really helpful if I could pull up my copy of the exam, but I do not remember how to do that. Did we get a copy sent to us?
Everybody should have got theirs mailed back. Hold on, I'm going back. Oh, Harvey really flamed me in these chats in retrospect. I mean, I'm sorry, buddy. I don't like. He had good points. All I'm saying is he had very, very good points.
He did.
It was the sensitivity question.
Yeah, the economically insensitive goods versus. Yeah, I would like to have an explanation of what that actually means.
Yeah. So let me get down there. The deadweight, because I'm gonna skip over some of the graph parts because you guys did good on that. Oh, real quick, the one that. You guys did really good on, which the term tax incident refers to the actual division of burden of a tax between buyers and sellers in a market. I love that you guys crushed that one. I was a huge fan of that because I'm like, oh, these are people who are actually doing this. Like they're actually out there worrying about getting hit in taxes.
I might have blanked out on that one. So I don't remember it at all.
that was a good one. This is making for absolute great radio right now. This is top tier. What are you looking for? Let me scroll down to that.
My problem is I have so many emails now. I don't remember which email I used when I signed up for this exam, so I don't know where to even find my exam.
one of my favorite ones, by the way, guys, is I think it was like one of the later questions. I have like a little notepad of like the funny insights I was gonna on this one.
Yeah.
And what is marketing to an economist?
Yeah.
We have opinions on marketing. In it, you know, marketing is advertising the product. Marketing is, you know, is determining which products to produce. Marketing is designing the product. Marketing is deciding how to distribute the product. And the answer was E, all the above. I think almost all the E's, all the above, were the right answers.
Right, they usually are.
Yeah, and yeah, I mean, we do. A lot of economists, and I'm not saying if I agree with this or not, view marketing as a reduced version of microeconomics, where it's just like you're only focusing on what is happening inside the market itself. My students did really good on that, because that's just a definition question. That's just something in the textbook. But marketing to economists is just such an interesting field, because we view marketing and like if you go into advertisement, it's two completely wholly separate fields. I was talking to an undergrad recently about this. You know, advertisement is how do you package something and how do you convey information over, you know, a finite amount of time or over with a finite amount of resources. Marketing is this kind of weird sciencey thing where you're trying to understand why people are buying stuff. But as an economist, we don't really question that people want to increase their utility. Like, people want to be happier. We don't think there's like a science to that.
Oh, so every time you shit on marketing, you're not necessarily crapping on advertising.
No,
you just view them completely different. Marketing is kind of why do you need to explain why somebody's doing something that you know they're going to do kind of idea?
Yes, like I think people would want a toothbrush.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I need to watch toothbrush commercials.
Right. You know that they're going to be buying toothbrushes. That just advertising is how you figure out which one you're going to buy.
Yeah, there's a part of microeconomics that actually believe that the only reason companies engage in marketing is because other companies are engaging in marketing, and it's a prisoner's dilemma. That it's like, if I don't market, then the other guy won't market. Then the other guy will market. I'll be worse off. So I'm better off marketing because I know the other guy's going to market, and creates this arms race of people spending money on marketing for what may not have an actual marginal advantage. Huh. Somebody's going to yell at me later on about that.
Maybe. Okay, I finally found my questions on here. One that here that stands out then, the free trade more likely to benefit a large populous country or a small country with fewer people?
Do you have the number beside that one?
No, there's no numbers on this. It was after the specialization. Let's see. After the apples, demand for salt, all those. It's towards the end.
The organic apples. Is free trade more likely to benefit a large populous country or a small country with fewer people?
Yeah.
A smaller country with fewer people. Yeah.
Really?
So, yeah, this is kind of interesting. So there's a couple different reasons why. The first is that the opportunity cost of a smaller population is greater. If you think of it, you have a large distribution of people that think of the most productive worker at the middle, right? The median productive worker. How much different is he from the person right behind him? Pretty similar, right?
Yeah.
But if you only have 10 people, the difference between the fifth guy and the fourth guy is probably a pretty big difference. Right. So as you increase the amount of workers you have in an economy, what you're actually doing is reducing the variation of the exception to having a skill set. So you're just more likely to have more people. And the more people you have, or the more workers you have, the more likely that you have a higher amount of specialized workers who are skilled at something. So trading one for one with those individuals, like if they went and worked at a different job, you're not really sacrificing that much. But if you have a really, 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 really tiny population, losing one doctor can have a massive impact. Where if you lose one doctor in the United States, it doesn't really have an impact because you're dividing out that work, that continued production, over a much larger group of people. So it doesn't feel as marginally impactful. So free trade there's also economies of scale. You got to remember, like, why do farms keep getting bigger? Well, there's a lot of fixed costs in farming. So one farmer can produce more once they buy the tractor. As long as that one tractor can keep working, you can buy your neighbor's farm and the farm beside him and the farm beside him and the farm beside him. And that tractor just keeps driving in a straight line. And you're exponentially increasing the output with one worker and a fixed amount of capital. And when you talk about reducing or your marginal cost or average variable cost starts to decline pretty dramatically, it makes cheaper goods. Well, that same thing happens between two other economies. When one has a bunch of people and one has a smaller group, that absolute advantage in production, and in some cases, like with farming, like you have in the U.S., still has that competitive advantage. When it comes, I'm talking about gross, like calorie production. I'm talking about like specific goods. then it's good to trade with them because you can never get that scale. But because you're trading, you have free trade with them and there's no penalty for trading with the other country, you're getting that economy of scale as if you had that very large population.
Oh, okay. Okay, I see.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll throw you guys out something crazy. So in 1880, the 1880 census, 50% of Americans were farmers. Mm-hmm. The last census, 1% of Americans were farmers.
History isn't just boring names and dates. It's weird, messy, and full of what-were-they-thinking moments. The Buck Starts Here dives into the financial fiascos, questionable deals, and outright chaos that helped build America, $1 at a time. We mix in serious history from a fresh perspective. Real, deep dives into the numbers and the moments that shaped the country without the boring lecture. From presidential blunders to almost states and the time an international war almost started over a pig, we break down the key events that made, and nearly broke, the nation. It's the fascinating untold history you won't find in the textbooks. Subscribe to the Buck Starts Here podcast for a deeper look at presidential history that's anything but dull.
Longtime fans of the show should be familiar with the lender formerly known as Sue Pullen, and I'm pleased to announce that she's back, fresh off a rebrand and ready to help as Sue Mackey. Sue is a certified mortgage advisor at Fairway Independent Mortgage, an equal housing lender who focuses on finding the right product for you and your needs. She has over 20 years of experience helping thousands of homeowners. Whether it's purchasing, refinancing, or even a reverse mortgage, Sue will help. Sue's licensed in 36 states now, so reach out and let Sue Mackey it happen for you. The best way to reach her is just give her a call at 520-977-7904 or in an email, spullen@fairwaymc.com. Fairway Independent Mortgage has an MLS number of 2289. Sue Mackey has an MLS number of 206048. That email again, spullen@fairwaymc.com. And that phone number is 520-977-7904. Shoot Sue an email and let her know she needs to update that address.
To everyone who loves the taste of tradition, come enjoy a classic Wisconsin fish fry at Culver's.
I'm Genesis from Culver's in Claremont, Florida. And here, family fish fry is a part of who we are. We've been serving up fish fry favorites for over 40 years, all thanks to the Culver Family Roots and Wisconsin Supper Clubs, the place where the fish fry was perfected. If you're craving something crispy on the outside and flaky on the inside, you've got to try our hand-battered North Atlantic cod. It's perfectly seasoned and my personal favorite. Or if you're in the mood for a little extra crunch, our lightly breaded butterfly jumbo shrimp hits the spot every time. Whatever you order, I promise it will be made with love by a team who cares, because we want every guest to feel like family. That's just how we do it in Wisconsin. Dive into delicious with all your fish fry favorites at Culver's.
From Wisconsin with love, welcome to delicious.
So I remember being taught about that in school, about how all of the small-time farmers basically banded together to create collectives. And then that's kind of like what did in like the individual, like single farmers. Like, they just couldn't compete with like the factory farming scales until they started combining to make that collective.
Yeah, no, they really couldn't. And even, you know, in the United States, see, the United States actually distributes wealth pretty aggressively for a developed country. That's one of the weird accusations I hear, like, oh, the U.S. doesn't redistribute wealth. I'm like, yeah, we do. But unlike in Europe, we redistribute wealth through subsidies, mm-hmm. not through advantageous, not like through tax refunds or something like that. So like we make corn cheaper because the U.S. government will engage with corn farmers to subsidize corn farm production. We do have some protective tariffs. I don't know if you've heard like recently that the dairy tariff that the Canada
has.
Well, that's a very interesting tariff that's been studied in economics for a while.
It's based on a quota too, right? I mean, that doesn't kick in immediately. After a certain threshold,
Yeah, Kyle, so you're 100% right. So we have this concept of, it's an Econ 201, this idea of binding. So non-binding price floor, non-binding price ceiling basically means not enough of the economies interacting there, the equilibrium. If it's a price ceiling, it's below it. If it's a price floor, it's above it. If nobody's interacting at that point, then it has no effect. So that's why you see like tariffs mixed with quotas, where it's really just meant to penalize overproduction to flood a market with something. Same reason why we put tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles. And that concept is kind of existed in a while. Like, is it a real tariff? Is it a real barrier or impediment? And we like don't have enough experience with it to know really if it is. But controversially, one of the most common examples of a non-binding price floor is minimum wage. Mm-hmm. There isn't enough of the population earning minimum wage that actually makes anybody richer or poorer. I should say there are some studies that it makes like the bottom 10 percentile of workers poorer. But that's where like why don't we make minimum wage $100 an hour? Well, that would be above the price. That'd be above the equilibrium, become a binding price floor. And then you would see, you know, all these crazy economic effects. But raising minimum wage up or down, we don't see an effect to the market with it because the equilibrium is so high above it. I always say like minimum wage is kind of an interesting one because it really doesn't work either positively or negatively because there just isn't enough people. Only 1.1% of workers over the age of 25 earn minimum wage. That's too small of a percentage to move the market.
I think you dropped that fact on us the first time one of the very first times we had you on when you're talking about minimum wage, and that was one of the things that kind of blew my mind. They make it sound like everybody's on it, like 50% of the population, but no, it's much, much less than you think.
Yeah, I've never had anybody answer that question right.
Mm-hmm. I still would have gotten it wrong.
No, like people are like 20%, 30%. I'm like, no, yeah. Very, very, very tiny amount. That's why I'm like, we could solve most of those problems with just like more education, like just giving people like trade education. Like, you could probably solve this quite easily.
Yeah.
Are there any other ones you want to highlight? Do you want me to go back to picking out the goofy ones I found?
Yeah, if you want to go through that, guys in the chat, if there's any specific questions that threw you guys for a loop that you want to rant about, let me know. Just drop it in the chat. We'll get Eric to look at that and explain himself.
You can yell at me, too. You can just straight up insult me. That's always I hope everybody knows that's always an option.
And there's some interesting ones on collusion that you had in here about why doesn't every industry become a cartel?
That is something I like, actually genuinely question in my life.
Yeah.
I mean, it's why doesn't every industry become a cartel? Because it's illegal. It's like, all right, so there's no drugs and violence in the U.S.
Right.
When I was much younger or earlier in my career, obviously growing up pumping gas, growing up following the oil market, I'm obsessed to this day with OPEC. OPEC is the most confusing thing in the world to me. Because they act like it was formed for economics. No, it was formed because to fight U.S. U.S. dominance in a market. Like that's all it was founded for. Half the countries in OPEC don't benefit from it at all. Like it hurts them, and the other half don't really benefit either. And the halves that do benefit will trade that additional benefit to be closer to the U.S. Like Saudi Arabia will be like, "Yo, can I get some Abrams?" Like we'll monkey around with our oil production. And I'm like, so who is this benefiting? The guys who don't benefit at all from OPEC are so poor that like they have domestic issues. And the wealthy guys are like, hey, thanks for this benefit. You know how we formed this group so we could counter U.S. dominance? We just want to get close to the U.S. because they have some really cool fighters I can't see on the screen.
Right.
That's like what it is. It cracks me up. And then it's like OPEC, got bigger and bigger and bigger. But then they like, the nations that the U.S. really that OPEC should have protected, like the concept of OPEC, right? Like the concept of like we're all going to get together and we're going to dominate this super important energy, this super important resource in the world, because like it will protect us from a unipolar world, like Iran and Venezuela. The U.S. just sanctioned them to oblivion, anyways. Like, and OPEC was like, "Oh, that's wild. Can we have some more Abrams?"
So how did De Beers get away with it then?
It's just like, have you ever, like, it's like the resource curse? It's like resource curse is this concept of you discover a resource before you have institutions. And so everybody just exploits the crap out of that resource and there's no institutions to tax or to funnel that money into its area. And so all that money leaves that area instead of being converted to capital and your economy intensifying, going from, resource extraction to manufacturing to service base, we call that economic intensification. Instead, all that wealth, that capital that should have been reinvested in your economy spills out. And then the people left there, and like, I'm wearing a shirt with the state that's like famous for the resource curse, West Virginia, because like we had all,
a lot of coal.
A lot of coal. And there was like in oil and natural gas. And like Sisterville West Virginia, which is one of the coolest places in the world, in my opinion. It has all these beautiful homes because it was like the richest place for 10 years in the United States in the 1890s. Because it was at, like, there's rail depots, there was coal extraction, there was oil. Remember, the first oil bust was in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And then all that wealth fled. Conversely, the poster child of the opposite of the resource curse is South Dakota. So South Dakota discovered all this natural gas, but South Dakota discovered natural gas didn't really, I mean, we should just throw natural gas away. We should just, like, flare it off. Like, it's not actually flare it off. We just let it go in the atmosphere, which is horrible. Like, the worst thing in the world. It's like 83 times worse than CO2. But they had institutions in place. So they're like, yo, here's what we're going to do. All these oils and gas facilities that are here. Cool. Have fun extracting the stuff that we need. The whole world needs it. It's weird to pretend that, like, this is a bad thing going on when the whole world's like, no, we need this. We're just going to tax you to offset that marginal social cost of you extracting this. We're going to plow it into our schools, into our roads, into our infrastructure. And now, like, South Dakota is, like, just becoming a more advanced economy from that resource extraction because the institutions are already in place. So,
yeah.
And, like, so the concept of carteling is, this makes people really uncomfortable when I talk about this, is everything's essentially an oligopoly. Like, you go to the grocery store, you're dealing with oligopolies, right? Because there's look around. Are there as many buyers of shampoo as there are producers of shampoo?
Right.
No, that'd be wild. everything's an oligopoly. Everything is one or two moves away from being a cartel. Cartels are illegal oligopolies that fix prices. So the question becomes, like, is that good or bad? Should we push for free markets? Is a free market valid?
Didn't we just recently talk about even the threat of another person coming in and filling a gap and a competitive market can keep prices suppressed?
Yeah. So, and that's the bears. So mm-hmm. cartels and monopolies actually function the exact same when it comes to basically the market will equalize at where their marginal revenue equals marginal cost as opposed to supply and demand, right? Marginal cost, marginal benefit. So, then with oligopolies is that it's a group, more or less, I don't want to say a group decision, because not all oligopolies are price fixing. Cartels are price fixing. That's the only difference between just a regular oligopoly and a cartel is they're price fixing. They're all agreeing to sell at one point. Where if there's a threat of competition, though, it doesn't matter how good or how bad your price control is. If everybody's nervous a third guy can walk in, well, you're going to change your behavior. That's what, in oil, that's what happened with Kuwait. Mm-hmm. You know, Kuwait wasn't part of OPEC and during Desert Storm, and that's why Iraq went in Kuwait also because they owed Kuwait a bunch of money after the war with Iran.
But is that the way, like, we have our markets and, like, systems set up here in the U.S. is that basically what keeps monopolies from forming? Then is just the fact that it is open for anybody to join in and, like, throw their hat into the ring.
Yeah, I mean, the barriers that form oligopolies are usually not state sanctioned. Mm-hmm. They're usually a product of, like, airlines that just expensive to buy aircraft. But Kyle, you are right about that. It's that threat of competition is what creates it. Monopolies, though, we have tons of monopolies in the United States. The biggest creator of monopolies is the U.S. government, right. And the biggest killer of monopolies is
the U.S. government.
The dress busting is.
Yeah.
So we have this idea of, like, government franchising. And that was actually, you know, one of the questions on the exam, I believe, which is that, you know, what is a government franchise? Well, you know, government can impose barriers to entry. So if we go, this is more on the oligopoly side, but it was question 37. Like, how can government impose barriers to entry? You know, and it gives a bunch of examples, but one of them is the government can require occupational licensing to provide goods and services. The government could just say, you can't do X unless you have Y. Mm-hmm. And then only issue one of Y. And
yep.
Like, we have around here, like, we have one natural gas provider. We have one electricity provider. And it just is what it is.
Yeah.
Is that good or bad?
For municipal functions, those seem to be the monopolies that I'm most familiar with seeing. Like, the who provides your electricity, who provides your water, who provides your trash services.
Yeah. So in Massachusetts, you're right about that. For electricity and natural gas, that's 100% private here.
Mm-hmm.
But they have a government franchise. The government says you're the only person who can do that. And that's because for two reasons. One is the amount of capital it's required to invest to rerun all new pipes for natural gas would be so high that if you had multiple competition, if somebody was like, I'm only going to have 40% of the market, and another guy's going to have 40%, a third guy's going to have 20%, their marginal benefit's too low. So you end up with nobody doing natural gas at all.
Right.
With electricity, it's a two-parter. One, it's that same logic, running poles, but the municipalities usually own their poles in a lot of cases. In Massachusetts, we don't. National Grid owns their poles. We have rights to put like the lights on poles and stuff like that. It gets kind of weird. But actually, lighting comes back to New York City under Edison and Westinghouse. Tesla was probably involved in this too. Don't get me wrong here. If you ever want to look up, there's crazy pictures of like a million, I'm not joking, like blocking out the sun amount of power lines because people were like, they would run power lines to like one individual home. And then Edison's was DC, so you had to have a line coming back the other way.
Edison, like, with DC, there's no transforming. So you need the alternating current in order to get the transformer action. So you can't use step up or step down. So
There's no transformer in DC.
They're very specialized, and they're not like an AC transformer. An AC transformer uses the AC current in order to use the induction or to induce the field and transfer it across the isolation set of windings. DC, you can't do that because you don't have alternating current. It's direct current. So there's no magnetic field like expanding and collapsing. There's nothing to take advantage of there. So the benefit of AC is you can step up the voltages extremely high, drop the current way down, and then now you have a lot less losses because you're not burning off as much heat because there's less current flowing through everything. Yeah. With DC, you can't do that. It becomes much more difficult to step down. So with AC, you can run everything across the country at like 128 kV or 600 kV, and then by the time you're getting down into neighborhoods, then you're stepping down to 13.8 kV, and then from there 480, then 480 to 120. 120 to houses.
I got really curious about transformers work like probably 15 years ago.
It's the simplest of the equations.
And it made me realize that like one dude figuring out how to transfer, like create a grease that allows electric fields to go through it is what powers the modern world. Like some random like scientist, some random chemist who will like probably don't know the name of, I'm sure we probably know the name of him, was just like, wait a minute, I discovered this grease that allows electric fields to transfer them. Suddenly your house can be powered without it burning down. We should really be more thankful to that dude.
Gonna have to show me that. I'm not familiar with this grease. Is this the silicone compound that I use to grease my MODs?
Yeah, it's like a compound that's inside everything from like silicate to the oil that's inside transformers and stuff like that. Like it's wild. Some random dude is just like came up with this idea. It's like the Velcro guy. It was like, wait a minute, hooks, loops, guys, hear me out here from space travel. Like, right. Dude, like that's like, I was reading something really funny and they asked a bunch of astronauts, like, what's the most important thing to space travel? And it was some hilariously high amount. We're like, Velcro. It's Velcro. Velcro is like the most important thing. Because like everything, it'd be so hard to do anything without Velcro. I'm just like I love this. I love really simple ideas that become real. O-rings. Whoever thought of the O-ring is like should go down as the same level as the guy who invented fire. All right, like harness fire.
There's been a lot of things that have blown up from O-rings.
Yeah, right. Yeah, never the O-ring. It's always the O-ring not being there. That's at fault. Nobody's ever had too many O-rings. So with the bear, so here's another crazy question. This number might be a little dated, but you know what the average cost of the average price of 1 carat of diamond is in the world?
Mm-mm.
It's like $10.
Yeah, that seems about right. Like extremely low, right?
It's extremely low. It's like, and I think in the U.S. right now, a carat of refined diamond, of like jewelry diamond, is like over $3,000.
Right,
and
you can thank the bears for that.
Yeah, well, no, like De Beers was like ultimate marketing. They were just
the whole diamonds are forever, and like, why do you buy a diamond engagement ring? That was all De Beers. Before then, it was like sapphires and rubies and things like that were just as likely to be in an engagement ring.
Yeah, and it's funny. So my wife has it's a diamond with two sapphires for her engagement ring because she likes blue a lot. But I always thought it was funny when I was studying geoscience. We went down to an old mine and we were talking about I had so many good professors there, but like an excellent geoscience professor. And she shows us like coal, right? And she basically like walked through the different compositional stages of carbon. And what was funny is you realize like diamonds are there's nothing after a diamond, right? Like,
yeah.
So in theory, there should be a ton of diamonds, and everything before diamond, there should be less of. So the idea, and I'm sitting there as an econ major, taking a geoscience minor, and I'm like, oh, wow, this is a great example of how successful De Beers marketing was, of that creating scarcity, because it's not real scarcity. It's just not there.
What about the fact that like the perfect, the best, most pristine example you can have of a diamond is worthless because it's too good?
Yeah, isn't that like, don't they have
isn't that, pro- is that wild?
Yeah, they have problems like testing diamonds, like that are that nice. You know when cubic zirconium came out? It was like right around the same price. Not right around, but relatively the same price as a diamond, because it was such a novel approach.
Dude, you ever watch somebody light a diamond on fire?
I watched a YouTube video of somebody doing that.
Isn't that wild?
Poop ton of CO2. It's hilarious.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's this like, but like that's, like honestly, I think that's like question like, 35 through like 39. It's this idea of like how firms attract to markets. One thing the group did great, I don't know if Robert's still on, but Robert crushed this section, which is asking about the movie studios ticket splits.
Oh, yeah. That one was fun.
That was, that was awesome, because I could see you guys being like, my students will think of this as I am staring at a market. I'm staring at graph paper of these two guys making decisions, and all I can think of is half you guys are probably thinking you're the movie studio, and the other half are probably thinking you're the cinema. Like, how do I screw this other guy?
I was trying to look at it from both sides, and I think that kept paralyzing me because I kept finding ways to answer that. I don't have the questions on here. I just have the answers. I just have the question, but I remember looking back at that. I remember thinking that it could apply to like everything. Like, it's like, God damn it, this is a really tough question.
Well, like, in what's funny and what I really like about that question is that it's a real life example of something that like actually happened. And
yeah,
what messes with people more, I'm telling you right now, is that article is written in 2017, not after the pandemic and before we can, you know,
right.
People had a gig supply or 10 gig supply of, you know, data going into their house.
So let's work through this question. I want to hear like you actually work through it, because this one, I think this one did kind of mess with me a little bit.
Do you want me to read the introduction into it?
Yeah, let's just do the whole question.
It'd be great if you're like, no.
Yeah, no. We're all set. We're fine. Read it twice already.
Movie studios split ticket revenues with the owners of the movie theaters that show their films. Once a movie is no longer shown in theaters, theater owners earn nothing further from the films. But studios continue to earn revenue when the movie is available from home viewing on DVD, Blu-ray, streaming, and cable. Theater owners would prefer that the time between when a movie appears in theaters and when it becomes available for home viewing be as long as possible. Typically, movies are not available for home viewing for at least 90 days after they are first shown in theaters. An article in the Wall Street Journal in 2017 noted a possible change to this system. This is a quote. Hollywood studios are preparing to upend decades of traditions by releasing movies at home less than 4 to 5 days after they debut. I don't know why I kept trying to pronounce that, but debut on the big screen. End of quote. The article goes on to note that, quote, studio executives say they would prefer to reach a deal with theaters. One reason they have been reluctant to unilaterally announce a new policy, end of quote. All right. So the first question was, typically, would you expect that the profits of movie studios are more at risk from the bargaining power of theaters, or are the profits of theaters more at risk for the bargaining power of movie studios?
So this scenario, it seems like it should be the theaters that are more at risk.
Yeah. So it's the theaters.
Right? Okay.
Yeah. People, generally speaking, my students on a very similar question to this. Oh my God. I can see how long they spend on a question and they're just flip-flopping.
Flip-flopping. Really?
Yeah. The movie, like a lot of times, like, well, the movie studios, and here's where the logic comes. And again, some people just massacred this, did a great job. A lot of times, the kids in particular, because they're kids, because, you know, they're teenagers, right? They mm-hmm. they get their causality mixed up. Now, I think what traders are very good at is they don't, you guys don't mess up causality. Like, you're not like, oh, a stock's higher, therefore the balance sheet's better. It's like, no, no, no. The balance sheet's good. Right. Stock goes higher, right?
Yeah.
Or vice versa. So a lot of them were like, oh, no, no, the movie theaters have a ton of leverage because the movie studios can't show the films until after they're in the movie, after they're in their theater. It's like, well, no, the movie studios can just skip the theaters entirely.
Right.
Which we now see. I mean, this was written in 2017. We now see that that happened a lot during the pandemic. Yeah, I mean, the other most common one, so the most common right answer, and I mean, like, I think all but a couple guys who took this, maybe less, was that one. The profits of the theaters are more at risk because they are relatively fewer studios to supply movies, right? The next common one were...
The answer was worded, too, that was kind of a little weird. Like, that right there, because there's fewer studios to make movies, what does that have to do with anything to do with the deal that you're talking about here, with who shows it and who... And how long that is.
There's no substitute. The movie, if there was, say there was tons of movies being produced and only a few of them made it to the theater, then if some of the studios are like, oh, I'm going to bring mine direct release, well, the theater doesn't care because it has this infinite, this way bigger supply of movies to draw from.
I feel like you just snuck a tariff question in here.
Harvey just jumped in.
There's Harvey.
Robert got it right. Yes. Theaters don't have many choices. Again, not surprised that Rob crushed this, given how we did on the thing.
That's funny. I think I got to the same answer, but I got to it a different way. I got to it as who has the bargaining power, and it was kind of like what you said. Like studios can skip them. They don't give a shit. They're still going to get their money.
Yeah. So one of the examples, to actually steal what Rob said here, is one of the examples I give my students, driving with you, Kyle, is like who has the power in an auction.
The auctioneer, obviously.
The auctioneer, yeah. The guy who owns the asset that's getting auctioned. Mm-hmm. And you just expand from there. Like, all right, now there's two baseball cards being auctioned, but there's still 800 people who want to buy them. The movie theaters, and then you can get into the business side of it. Like, the movie theaters need the movies. People don't go to movie theaters because I like movie theaters. They go to movie theaters to see a movie.
Right.
It's the weirdest industry in the world. Like, weirdest industry in the world. It's like, I'm going to buy something for you. I'm going to sell you a ticket to come here, and it's a reason you're coming here, but I'm going to sell it to you for a loss because I want you to buy a bunch of popcorn.
Right.
It's like a weird industry.
Yeah, it is a little bit.
I want you to buy the cheapest thing that this country produces in volume, and it's going to be super low labor costs for me to produce, and I'm going to put another thing we produce a ton of butter on it, and I'm going to somehow convince you that's worth $14 to buy.
I mean, it is pretty good.
It is good. Dude, you can order... movie theater popcorn on DoorDash now.
Yeah, I mean, I think AMC is now actually selling it in like grocery stores.
What? Anybody who thinks our economy's not doing well, I will show me in the Soviet Union where you could order movie theater popcorn to your house on your phone. The same thing I use to pass time when I'm pooping can deliver me popcorn. I love this country. That is a great place.
Am I leaving that in there? I'm going to leave that in there.
You can leave that in there. I'm fine with that.
Right, well, I think that's probably a good place to call it. So please join me in thanking Eric for explaining all his trickery. And technically, if you listen to today's episode, you should be able to leave feedback on his Econ 201 class that he teaches over at West Virginia University. Make sure all that stuff is in the show notes to make it as easy as possible for you. We'll be back soon with another exciting guest full of new ways to test our patience. But until that day, like, share, subscribe, all the things, and have a green week.
Again, I was just I know I sound like a broken record, but it was cool just to see how good you guys were at this stuff. Like, it makes me, like, as an economist, I'm like, okay, good. People understand this? Like, this is something that people use.
Did you talk to your class about what we're doing? What did they have to say about it?
I had a couple students in office hours, like, a couple weeks ago, and I was talking about, like, because, you know, the kids, I love them, but they get down on themselves, man. Like, they get, oh, this is so hard. And it is. And, like, I'm not, so, like, half my job is being a cheerleader. Like, you can learn this. And, like, the kids do great on the exams. They do excellent. You got to get them riled up a little bit. I told them about this. And they're, oh, cool. Because, like, a lot of their parents look at their homework, too.
Oh, really? Dang, we could have gotten some parents in with us, too.
Yeah, the parents love it because, like, they always want to, like, I've had a couple times when the parents are like, can I ask you a quick question? It's like, my boss said this. And I'm like,
your boss is stupid.
It feels Robert... weird because he'll call me Professor Mason. I'm like, I feel like I'm too young to be Francis. I think I hear him. Nope.
No.
God, is your cat meowing in the background?
Yeah, they're
trying to. Mine was just meowing too.
She is very mad. Hey, buddy, come on.
Sometimes I'll be in class and somebody will have like a cat and I'll be like, put him on camera. I want to see your cat.
My cat, you only see her butt.
Oh, what a cutie.
Are you looking for legit ways to make extra money? Our friends at The Side Hustle Show have put together this cool free 60-second quiz to help you do just that. All you got to do is go to hustle.show. You can do it right from your phone. Answer a few short multiple choice questions and it'll recommend a few episodes of the hit Side Hustle Show podcast to start with. You can add your personalized Side Hustle Show playlist to your device, learn what works, and start making more money today. Again, that's at hustle.show or follow the award-winning Side Hustle Show in your favorite podcast app.
This podcast is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It does not constitute financial or investment advice and should not be construed as such. The hosts, guests, and contributors of this podcast are not licensed financial advisors, brokers, or professionals. Any trading or investment decisions made based on the content of this podcast are solely at the listener's discretion and risk. Trading and investing in financial markets carry inherent risks, and past performance is not indicative of future results. Listeners should conduct their own research and seek advice from qualified financial professionals before making any financial decisions. The views, opinions, and information shared in this podcast are those of the individual contributors and do not necessarily reflect the views or policies of the podcast creators or associated organizations. Produced by China Shop Productions.